And so that's why we need a broad-based tax.
A bipartisan coalition gets to work on a budget plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 23rd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Kenai Peninsula Borough wrestles with its invocation policy.
To exclude another belief is beyond me. We represent every single person in this borough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
After more than two decades of Republican control, the Alaska House is now led by a bipartisan caucus. Democrats make up the majority of the 22-member caucus, along with two independents and three Republicans. Republican Representative Paul Seaton of Homer is a member of the caucus and the newly appointed co-chair of the House Finance Committee. Seaton says he joined the bipartisan coalition because the legislature must move forward on developing a sustainable fiscal plan.
I do not think it was at all fiscally conservative just to deplete our savings accounts in the last couple of years instead of looking at how do we diversify our revenue.
The caucus has already begun to discuss a new fiscal plan, Seaton says. One key component is the institution of a broad-based tax.
We don't pay any state sales tax. We don't pay any state income tax. We don't pay any state property tax. And yet we receive all the services, whether it's corrections, the courts, the troopers, the roads, all of those things. And so that's why we need a broad-based tax.
A multi-part approach will help distribute the burden among Alaskans, Seaton says.
A broad-based tax can be designed to hit higher income individuals, whereas the reduction in the PFD hits lower income individuals, so that you can get more of an equality or an equitable distribution of the pain across Alaskans.
The Alaska House will reconvene during the next legislative session beginning January 17, 2017. Interior Regional Alaska Native Corporation Doyon is not giving up on finding oil and gas in the Nenana Basin southwest of Fairbanks. That's despite more than a decade of exploration with various partner companies, including a third well drilled with Cook Inlet Region Incorporated this past summer that, again, did not deliver a commercially developable deposit.
It's discouraging every time you drill a well and don't have success, don't get me wrong.
Aaron Schutt, president and CEO of Doyon, which leases or has subsurface rights to over 270,000 acres in the Nenana and adjacent Minto Basin, says he remains optimistic.
Three wells we've drilled, I wouldn't say they've condemned any of the other parts of the basin yet.
Schutt says successful oil and gas projects elsewhere in Alaska, including on the North Slope, show that it typically requires a lot of exploration. Doyon's next project will be a 3D seismic survey of a 64-square-mile area to the north of last summer's drill site. Like past seismic work in the region, Schutt says the survey is aimed at mapping potential reservoirs.
Looking for trapping structures, really. We're not concerned about the basin generating sufficient hydrocarbons to have a commercial find somewhere. We just haven't found a structure where the gas and oil are trapped in concentrations that you can extract them commercially.
Schutt says if a survey indicates a potential reservoir, another well will be needed to verify it. He says the seismic work is slated for this winter and adds that SERI is scheduled to decide next month if it's on board with the project. For the past 4 months, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly has debated whether it should restrict who is allowed to give the invocation that begins each meeting. The controversy began in early August when a member of the Satanic Temple gave an invocation ending with the words, "Hail Satan." In response, the Borough Assembly instituted a new policy that limits who can give the invocation. Critics say this restrictive policy may put the borough at risk for a lawsuit, but efforts to amend it have stalled. KBBI's Shayla Farzan has more.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly policy on the invocation or prayer that begins each meeting will stay the same, for now. Under the current policy, only people or religious associations on a pre-approved list are allowed to give the invocation. According to a memorandum released by Borough Mayor Mike Navarre's office on November 9th, the Assembly has received, quote, numerous comments challenging the legality of the invocation policy. Borough Assembly President Kelly Cooper and Assembly Member Dale Bagley introduced a resolution on Tuesday that would have amended the current policy. In a statement to the Borough Assembly, President Cooper argued that they should not restrict who is allowed to give the invocation.
In my opinion, the policy we now have has many problems. The very notion that any belief system would want to exclude another belief is beyond me. We represent every single person in this borough.
For nearly an hour, the Assembly heard public testimony on the resolution. Nancy Henriksen of Kenai expressed frustration about the amount of time the Assembly has spent debating the invocation issue.
That you would even consider spending any more time or money on this issue troubles me. Each of you has a responsibility to uphold the Constitution. I'm charging you with that responsibility this night.
Sterling resident Peggy Peterson asked the Assembly to reconsider the idea of replacing the invocation with a moment of silence.
Having a moment of silence does not prohibit free exercise of religion. Every person here would be free to pray as they saw fit. That would not only protect religious freedom, it would avoid alienating members of the community. An added bonus, it doesn't violate the Constitution.
Eric Glatt, staff attorney for the ACLU of Alaska, reiterated that the borough should not control who is allowed to give the invocation.
Tests that control which members of the public may offer invocations before assembly meetings violate core constitutional principles. The ACLU of Alaska believes the best policy is the simplest policy. Return to the successful practice of allowing anyone in the borough to give an invocation on a first-come, first-served basis, or do without invocations altogether.
After some debate, the Assembly approved an amended version of the resolution in a 5-4 vote, which would have eliminated the invocation policy altogether. But as the meeting came to a close, Assemblymember Blaine Gilman gave notice of reconsideration. This temporarily halts any action on the issue and returns the Assembly to the current invocation policy. Currently, any Assembly member can give notice of reconsideration unless a resolution passes by supermajority. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly will now have the option to reconsider the resolution at their next meeting on December 6th. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, efforts to restore salmon to a dry stream.
That's only appropriate for the native people that have been impacted for almost 100 years to be able to play a role, to be able to be a part of bringing the fish back.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The U.S. Forest Service is offering another round of grants promoting wood energy projects in Alaska. Earlier grants have helped design boilers and mills that produce wood pellets in southeast and interior communities. Forest Service Wood Innovation Coordinator Dan Parent says the money is meant to expand use of downed trees, mill scraps, and similar materials.
We're looking at ways of utilizing wood that needs to come out of the forest to reduce hazardous fuel loading or for forest health purposes. We're trying to create markets for that material that doesn't otherwise have strong markets.
He says most Alaska grants go to wood energy projects, but the program also helps develop new timber products, such as laminates, or expand existing markets. Parent says program guidelines limit how the money can be used. Applications must be submitted by January 23rd. An old dam on the Aklutna River is destined for destruction. The dam is on Alaska Native Corporation land, and it is hoped that when it comes down, salmon runs will return to the river. The demolition work is expected to be finished next year, but enticing fish back could take a lot longer because the hydropower facility upstream drains away river water, so there is not enough left for fish. But for now, we're clustered around an iPad in Aklutna Incorporated's conference room in Eagle River. Noelle Aspiras, a land development specialist with the Alaska Native Corporation, is showing drone video footage of the area around the deep ravine in which the old Aklutna Dam is situated.
Yeah, what I'm using is a DJI Phantom 4. And as far as I'm concerned, DJI is the leader in the drone market.
Resolution is incredible. Amazing. It's like being in the ship.
The drone in question is sitting on the conference table, in sharp contrast to the Alaska Native art and artifacts that decorate the walls of the room, as if its futuristic technology can somehow help reverse the damage caused by a century-old concrete structure that has frustrated the salmon cycle that's at the heart of Athabascan culture. Aklutna is the first tribe in the country to get involved in such a massive project, says Nick Francis, Aklutna's chief operating officer.
That's only appropriate for the native people that have been impacted for almost 100 years to be able to play a role. They take pride in that, and it's important for them, so they're proud to be able to be a part of bringing the fish back.
The overhead video of the 250-foot deep canyon is dizzying. A huge crane, some 400 feet high, is in position above the site. It was erected this summer and will be used to lower demolition equipment, bulldozers and the like, into the ravine when the work starts in earnest next year. The $7 million project is being funded by the Conservation Fund. Brad Micklejohn, the fund's representative in Alaska, is the spur behind the effort to get rid of the 1920s vintage dam.
This dam is an orphan dam. It really doesn't belong to anybody. It hasn't been maintained. So taking it down in a controlled fashion is better than the possibility of it failing catastrophically on its own at a very inopportune time.
Micklejohn says so far the work has gone smoothly and has come in under budget. Four out of the five permits needed for the project are in hand, with one more to go.
Because we are working in waters of the U.S., we need to get what's called a fill permit, because of the discharge of the sediment behind the dam has the potential to impact waters of the U.S. And we've just applied for our last major permit with the Corps of Engineers.
The sediment, he mentions, some 300,000 cubic yards of it, is a major problem. It has built up behind the dam for decades, and when the dam is down, it could wash downstream at such a rate as to hurt salmon habitat or damage state and Alaska Railroad infrastructure. Nick Francis picks up the story.
So we're only moving mechanically about 30,000 cubic yards of the 300,000 cubic yards that's behind the dam. The rest of the sediment, the lion's share of the sediment, dissipates through natural means, through the water flow that will be coming down the Aklutna River. Hydrologists did a model, and they said in as quickly as 2 years, that could dissipate.
Other dangers posed by the work include worker injury or a potential flood. Francis says both eventualities have been dealt with this year with the construction of a helicopter pad in case of a medical emergency and an elevated safety plateau above the floodplain. Dam removal work is on hold for the winter, but the plan is to resume the project in April or May of next year. Although the work is on track, Brad Micklejohn says the removal of the dam is only step one. Getting more water into the Aklutna River to encourage salmon runs will be the next and probably the more difficult step, because a consortium of utilities, Chugach Electric, Municipal Light and Power, and Matanuska Electric, hold the rights to Aklutna water.
Right now, that water is allocated for power, principally. And so the power companies have a legal obligation to restore in-stream flows for the fish into the Clutha River. So that's the state of play now. We've had a number of meetings with the power companies so far, generally cordial, and they understand that we're working to take this lower dam out with the expectation that water will be provided into the Eklutna River.
Although Mickeljohn suggests the old Eklutna hydro plant is obsolete, Matanuska Electric Association spokesperson Julie Esty says the old Eklutna hydro plant provides MEA with a small but valuable contribution toward the utility's rail belt energy needs. Mickeljohn says a 1991 agreement signed by the power companies with federal agencies requires environmental mitigation to compensate for the power plant's impact on the watershed. Golden Valley Electric Association customers will see a slight decrease in their monthly bills next month, but it won't be the substantial cut GVEA had hoped to give ratepayers because the co-op has run into more problems with its coal-fired Healy 2 power plant. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Golden Valley President and CEO Corey Borgeson says the co-op had hoped Healy 2 would be by now producing low-cost electricity generated by the cheapest fuel, coal. But he says a small explosion forced GVEA to shut down the plant earlier this month, and that means the average residential customer will see their next monthly bill go down by only about 65 cents.
The fact that we won't be able to be running this lower-cost coal energy from Healy 2 is going to impact our cost of power.
Borgeson says repairing damage caused by the November 2nd explosion will again delay startup of the coal-fired plant near Healy, this time by up to 4 months. He says the explosion caused about $1 million in damage to the system that feeds pulverized coal into a combustion chamber. A team of experts brought in by GVEA determined that's where the blast occurred.
There was a buildup of this coal dust in the area of the coal handling system, and during a process of where we were shutting down the plant, it became oxygen rich, and the small puff or explosion inside the coal handling tubes occurred.
No one was injured in the explosion, which Borgeson says caused about $1 million in damage to the fuel feeder system. He did not have an estimate on the cost of repairing another part of the power plant that also was damaged in the blast. He expects insurance will pay for most of the damage, which he says was not as extensive as that caused by a much bigger explosion at the plant in March. But he regrets the incidents will further delay Healy 2 from providing the low-cost electricity that GVEA officials had anticipated.
Healy Unit 2, when it is running and it is going, will lower our cost of power for our members.
This year's explosions were the latest in a series of mishaps that have kept Golden Valley from bringing Healy 2 online for nearly 4 years now. GVEA has invested more than $175 million to buy and upgrade the plant since the purchase was finalized in 2013. The 50-megawatt plant was built by state and federal agencies at a cost of more than $300 million to demonstrate technology that advocates said would use low-grade coal to generate electricity with less pollution. But it was never able to consistently do that and plagued with problems, so the agencies mothballed it in 2000. Borgeson says the unusual design of the plant makes it hard for GVEA to solve many of its problems.
The restart of Healy Unit 2 is become a much more difficult, perplexing effort than we had anticipated or hoped for.
GVEA management and board of directors talked about the blast on Monday in a closed-to-the-public executive session during the board's monthly meeting. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Moose and other species have advanced north with warming temperatures. University of Alaska Fairbanks Assistant Professor of Water and Environmental Research, Ken Tape, says movement of boreal species into far northern Alaska has corresponded over the last century with earlier snow and river ice melt. Tape explains that earlier breakup has allowed increased growth of vegetation.
It's not just a hydrologic metric, but really, it's really telling you when these shrubs growing in floodplains can get started.
That's allowed more widespread and taller willow shrubs. Tape says habitat surveys show that moose and snowshoe hares prefer willows at least 1 meter tall.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community.
Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
A national nonprofit group that provides service dogs to military service members and veterans has opened a new training facility in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Paws for Purple Hearts involves service members and vets in the dog training process.
The atmosphere is upbeat as people and dogs mix during an open house event at Paws for Purple Hearts' new Fairbanks facility. The young dogs, Labrador and Golden Retrievers, wearing blue vests, calmly interact with visitors amidst the distracting party atmosphere. They're young and still in training, but obviously special animals.
The most sedate, mellow, and calming dogs that we can find.
In Fairbanks for the open house, Paws for Purple Hearts national president and CEO Greg Sipple emphasizes that his group's service dog program is different.
A lot of places will try to have that dog keep the world away from the veteran. Our philosophy is help the veteran get through and integrate back into society. So we'll have the dog come closer to comfort them at times that their anxiety is high. Even when they're sleeping, the dog can sense the dreams, the emotions, and the cortisol that is being emitted, and the dogs will comfort the veteran.
Sipple, a former Navy pilot, also points to another unique aspect of the program, use of active duty service members and veterans suffering a range of disabilities, including PTSD, to help train the dogs.
Right now, the demand for service dogs is far outstretching the capacity of every organization combined. So what we're trying to do is make a force multiplier by having the veterans come in, training with the dogs once or twice or three times, or as many times as they really want to. Something about that magical connection between a dog and a human being and their ability to read and understand our emotions is really what is the magical part of the organization.
Fairbanks is one of five locations in the U.S. where Paws for Purple Hearts operates, and the first to get a purpose-built training facility. With a large veteran population and three military installations, the interior Alaska location makes sense, but Sipple credits two local residents with bringing the organization to Fairbanks.
My name's Betsy Jacobs, and I'm the program coordinator for Paws for Purple Hearts here in Alaska.
And I'm Nathan Collin, the director for Paws for Purple Hearts in the state of Alaska.
Jacobs and Collin, both longtime Fairbanks residents previously involved in therapy dog work, say they saw the need for service dogs.
I would often be asked, how do I get a service dog? I didn't have an answer for them. There was no place here in town that they could go to get a service dog.
So the couple got trained by service dog pioneer and Paws for Purple Hearts founder Bonnie Bergen in California.
Once Betsy and I both went through her program, she seemed to think we were good candidates, and she asked us if we would open up a Paws for Purple Hearts here in Fairbanks.
Since March, Collin and Jacob say the fledgling Fairbanks branch of Paws for Purple Hearts has worked with four dogs and about 25 service members and veterans.
Positive dog training, Susan Sampson has allowed us to use her facility free for the entire time, March until now.
Until we got our own facility now.
So we've only been meeting twice a week, but now that we've got our own place, we'll be able to expand our services immensely.
And the neat thing about our services is all our classes, all our events, everything for the servicemen and veterans are free. And if any of them want a dog, the dog is free.
That's a big deal, as the couple says trained service dogs can cost as much as $75,000. Paws for Purple Hearts CEO Sipple says the organization is entirely funded by private donations and grants, noting that Alaskan people and businesses have been generous in helping the organization get started, and he aspires to expand into Anchorage and Juneau. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
In Alaska, a white Thanksgiving is usually a given for most of the state, but not this year. The entire state is below normal for snowfall. Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. He told Annie Feit a white Thanksgiving is relatively rare for most of the U.S., but Alaska is a different story.
Everyone's familiar with a white Christmas, and so I thought it would be interesting to look at the climatology of a white Thanksgiving. So I went and pulled all the records for all the stations in Alaska and kind of crunched some numbers and found that Thanksgiving typically is, as most Alaskans know, is a full winter holiday with snow on the ground and possibly new snow and falling and cold temperatures.
What are the chances in Alaska for a white Thanksgiving?
Well, so there's two answers to that question. One is, what does it look like this year? And then what does the climatology look like? So the climatology is, in Anchorage, there's an 80% probability. And then when you work your way northward from Anchorage, it turns into basically 100%. So McGrath has a 100% record. Fairbanks has a 100% record. Barrow has a 100% record. And there's a few places in between that maybe have missed out once or even twice. And then once you go down to southeast, all the way down, say, to Ketchikan or Annette Island, you're looking at about a 15% long-term probability. This year, even though the entire state of Alaska is below normal for snowfall, there is at least 1 to as much as 5 or so inches of snow on the ground north of the Alaska Range. So, Fairbanks is going to extend their 100% record. McGrath is going to extend their 100% record. Barrow, and so on. So, but from Anchorage southward, the snow is very, very meager, and so a lot of places that typically have a white Thanksgiving, like Anchorage, aren't going to have one this year.
And you said everywhere in the state is below normal?
Right. So every single station that has a published normal daily snowfall, if you compare what should have happened by this point of the year versus what has fallen, all of them are below normal.
Do we have any idea why that is?
There's a lot of reasons in there, but we've had a kind of a stable weather pattern for the late fall and early winter, that there just hasn't been a lot of precipitation, and there's been more clear skies, and it's been a fairly stable pattern for an extended amount of time.
And how about you personally? Are you in favor of a white Thanksgiving?
Well, I think a lot of people here in Alaska are in favor of snow. I mean, it is Alaska, and it's supposed to snow. And here in town, without any snow on the ground, it's quite a bit darker. And the snow helps keep things brighter. There's a lot of recreational opportunities, riding on snow machines or skiing, that people just are having to hold off on until some snow falls. So I personally am in favor of snow. A lot of the people that I know are also in favor of snow, and I get questions all the time, when's it going to finally snow? And I don't have a great answer for that.
Climatologist Brian Brettschneider. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, or you can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shayla Farzan in Homer, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Annie Feit in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.